You listen to this podcast because you like books, or maybe because you like learning, or maybe you just like the sound of my voice lulling you to sleep. If it's the first two, Audible has you covered. Too busy to read? Driving and don't want to run into another dog? Audible is a huge library of audiobooks where people read to you like you're a kid again. And guess what? You can try it out for free. Just go to readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to sign up for your free trial today.
It definitely has always been something that made me happy. Like, it's something that you can really count on to bring joy in your life no matter what. Like, you can always do art. You can't always get what you want, but you can always kind of make something and get enjoyment and interest and kind of a mental adventure or whatever it is.
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I am your acclaimed host, John Monaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 20. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with Naomi Pitcairn about her book, Political Art Diary. Naomi is an artist and activist committed to advancing the urgent social needs of our times. She is passionate about the rights of immigrants, whistleblowers, Native Americans, and other oppressed minorities. Using disruptive art projects and purposeful pranks, along with her arts background, including her time as a Times Square billboard painter, she has masterminded over 50 gigantic street art chalks from the Bay Area to Baltimore and garnered a fair amount of positive press for her causes over the years. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hello, everyone, to Read, Learn, Live. This is John Monaster, your host. I am here with Naomi Pitcairn to talk about her book, Political Art Diary. Naomi, say hello.
Hello.
Hello. So glad to have you with us. I'm really excited. This was thanks. And I'm excited. This is a really interesting book. It's very, very different and very unique. And I'm really excited to talk to you about it. So I always like to start off with, in the author's own words, just tell us a little bit about the book. Tell us what your project is here.
Well, so many things happened during these political actions that I felt the need just to write down what happened. So I did, and then people said they liked it. I had just really thought of it as keeping a record. So I was kind of surprised that people liked it as it was, because it goes to a question you might ask later. What was like a revelation or something writing? And like, it's hard to tell if what you're writing is any good. At least I have that problem. Sometimes I think it's good and it's not. And so just telling it without any embellishments seemed to actually work, which surprised me a little.
Huh. So yeah, so let's get into the writing process a bit. You wrote this book, and you've kind of had a whole career, and we'll delve into that. But I was curious about why you decided you wanted to write the book now. Why is now the time?
Well, I was afraid I was going to forget what happened, and I always need something to do. So I always have loved books. So I had just finished a book about our family. Basically, we had all these old family pictures, and we had all these stories that my aunts and uncle had written or memories, and I'd put them all together into this family book for the family. And so I guess I just started putting the memories of the actions together as a kind of next thing to do.
That's interesting. So you have kind of a family history as well that you know about.
Yeah, when my mother died, there were all these photographs. Different people had different photographs, and they were all going to kind of get separated. So I wanted everybody in the family to have every picture. And my uncle had scanned in these photographs that my uncle who passed away had, and it ended up almost 800 pages long.
Wow.
And everybody in the family got a copy. And it was interesting. My aunts and uncle all had very simple, direct, but lovely to read writing styles. And you could almost, they almost flowed together. Like they didn't jar you when you switched from one writer to another, because they had all kind of had this humble, just telling what happened kind of style. And I, in a way, it probably influenced me writing what happened with the political actions after, you know, reading their style and just kind of admiring the simplicity and humbleness of their writing styles. It really worked. And my aunt just finished a book about her childhood memories called In the Shadow of the Dragon's Back, which is the Drakensberg Mountains. She grew up in apartheid South Africa, and she just wrote a book about that. So all these family memories were kind of happening from different directions.
Sure. So while you were writing the book, I'm always curious to hear about kind of revelations that happened, right? Because you know, you're trying to put all your memories down. So while you were writing, was there anything that particularly surprised you, or maybe you learned while you were researching for the book?
It just surprised me that people actually were interested in thinking it was publishable. That was the biggest surprise. I had just kind of kept a record, and it didn't seem like a book. It just seemed like a record. And then my friend Victoria said, no, this is a book. So that was the biggest surprise. I mean, most of the surprises came with the actions. There was all kinds of surprises in what happened with the actions. Like, we would plan something, and then there was always some kind of story that came out of it. And that just kind of happened based on the setup of the situation, I guess. That was surprising too. Some of the things that happened were very surprising.
Yeah. I can only imagine. I mean, so and kind of getting into that, the book is very unusual in the structure, right? The book is, there's lots of news clippings, photos, you threw in some police reports. It's a lot more visual than a regular book. And to me, it almost felt like a scrapbook, and kind of to getting back to what you said about what you're doing for your family. So why did you decide this was the best way to create the book instead of a more kind of normal, just written words straight away?
It's just because I'm such a visual person. Like, I've put together several books, and they were always very heavily visual. It's the book I want to look at. I always want more pictures when I'm looking at a magazine. I never have enough. So it's just visual greediness, I guess. And the pictures, a lot of the ones we took weren't very high quality. I've kind of been trying to change that. I actually hired a couple photographers for this latest project, because really all that's left from any of these is the record. So I'm kind of upping the quality now, but it definitely started out real scrappy and scrapbooky.
Yeah. And I think especially when, there's so many people involved in this book, and to have all their photos in it really helps humanize the book.
Yeah, they're just a bunch of fond memories, these people. Because most of them just walked up. We were doing something, and they walked up and they joined, and literally over like 200 people have just walked up and gotten to know a lot of them to varying degrees. And it's really interesting. Just to be on the street and dealing with anybody who happened to walk up.
Right.
Drunks are the only people that are really a problem. Drunks.
Yeah. I can imagine.
They like to roll in things. I don't know why, but they like to roll in their artwork.
I think I remember a photo you had of someone doing that.
Yeah, when Chalky Pie goes bad. Yeah. This girl, I don't know, man. It was pretty trippy.
But so let's roll it back now to help people understand what you're up to and where you came from. So what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pennsylvania, about an hour north of Philadelphia, in like a religious sect. Pretty much everybody in our town was in the same religion, Swedenborgianism. I don't think it really stuck with me as a religion, but probably the idea that ethics are important did stick with me. Like, maybe not exactly the same ethics, but ethics are very important to me. you know, not lying, doing the right thing, sticking up for people who need it, things like that. Mm-hmm. Because it was a very moral upbringing, whether or not you agreed with the morals, it was always, morals were always emphasized. Mostly sexual ones, because it was Christianity.
Right.
Those ones I'm not as interested in, but still, I mean, the idea that they were important, I think, was very kind of instilled in me, inculcated, so to speak.
Yeah. So kind of going from that, you know, you grew up in this very religious kind of small town environment. And somehow, so you went to school. Where along that path did you find yourself starting to create art and can start to consider yourself an artist?
You know, sometimes I still don't consider myself an artist because I don't always do art. Like, I've had mm-hmm. years where I didn't, but I always liked doing art. I mean, I did some art in high school and some in college. I didn't really think I was good enough to be an artist. I still wonder sometimes, but it definitely has always been something that made me happy. Like, mm-hmm. it's something that you can really count on to bring joy in your life no matter what. Like, you can always do art. You can't always get what you want, but you can always kind of make something and get enjoyment and interest and kind of a mental adventure or whatever it is from the creative process. Like, it's just, what would I say? It's just nurturing and fun, and it just takes the dullness out of life for me.
Sure. So maybe you've always been an artist then.
Yeah, I always knew I was bored.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I mean, I remember always wanting to do a project or something, because otherwise it was boring, you know?
Yeah.
That or look at nature. Those are the two things. And as a kid, there was a lot of nature and a lot of beauty, a lot of art around me, which was really fortunate, mm-hmm. I think. Right. Yeah. It really nourishes something in you.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, so it was a lot of getting away to get to that, but it's still there sometimes. So I agree, it's important, especially if you're in a big city like most of us, to find the nature, find the beauty.
Yeah. And there's a lot of beauty just in the weird cracks in the wall too, but it is kind of an active pursuit.
Yeah.
Any photographer, like, you're always just looking for unusual beauty in unusual places, I guess.
Right. Exactly. Trying to take a perspective that others don't. So you've had lots of interesting jobs. I'm just going to pick one that I thought was interesting. At one point, you were a Times Square billboard painter. So when was that and what was that like?
Well, when I got out of my undergrad art school at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art, I was living in an apartment building, and on top of the building, there was this cool jazz art festival billboard, and it was really beautiful, this guy in kind of golden light playing a trumpet on a black background. And I had been getting bigger and bigger with my art, and I wanted an even bigger canvas that would be public, so I decided I'm going to paint billboards. And men said that women didn't paint billboards, but there was this other woman in Philadelphia who was a freelancer, and she hired me. And once I was able to have the skills and I could paint faces and things like that, then I was able to get other jobs, and finally Times Square, which was kind of my goal, because they had the coolest, well, besides LA, they had the coolest, like, movie posters and cooler art. Like, a lot of New Jersey, when I worked there, was like cheap funeral homes and stuff, which did entertain me to paint the cheap funeral home billboard, but it wasn't very good art. So, yeah. I mean, the movie posters are always the most splashy. And
yeah. Do you have one in particular that stands out?
Well, did? I did Anthony Perkins for Psycho 3. That was that was 70 by 70 feet on the old Lowe's State Building, which is gone now. But that building itself was super cool, because it literally had, like, they paint over billboards. So you paint one billboard, then you white it out with a kind of an absorbent, non-shiny paint called Whiteout. And so there was layer after layer after layer, like Fay Wray with King Kong was in there somewhere. And the pointing was kind of going in the building. So there were these little chips that would come off, and they were like jawbreakers with lay all different colors. And you just wonder which painting was in your little chip. It just had all this history of really cool movie billboards. So, I mean, Anthony Perkins for Psycho 3 was only kind of cool and not as cool as King Kong, but you know, that was like one of my bigger movie billboards that I got to do.
Awesome. So sort of going from there, fast forwarding a lot to recent history, you're sort of known for your work with chalk. I think that's one of the big things, and you cover that a lot in the book, and you've got lots of great photos of all the different work that you've done. So, I mean, that's a really interesting medium, right? I don't know if I could name any other artist that I know of that is known for working extensively with chalk. And, you know, maybe that's just me, but I thought that's a very interesting choice. So I'm just curious about why you made that choice, why you felt chalk was...
Only one reason. I really am not crazy about chalk as a medium, because it's kind of clumsy and it's really dusty. The reason is because you can get away with it. Like in people's perception, chalk is removable. Chalk is innocent. I mean, if you think of Mary Poppins, Dick Van Dyke was a chalk artist, a sideway chalk artist. Mm. It's like hopscotch. So when you're exercising your First Amendment rights, which is mostly what we were doing with the chalk project, you have to make it chalk. Otherwise, they'll arrest you. Like it was often a game of cat and mouse, like trying to get away with it. At times we thought we were at pretty high risk of being arrested. So at those times I would chalk the First Amendment or mention it, because in all the chalk arrests, which I keep track of around the country, the judge never lets you mention the First Amendment at your trial. I'm not sure why, but it's a pattern. So I figured at my trial, hopefully it will be the evidence. So either they have to throw out the evidence or we're going to mention the First Amendment.
Sneak it in there.
Huh. Yeah, kind of, they'll have to choose. So like when we came down to Los Angeles and people had just been rubber bulleted and tear gassed for chalking at Art Walk, we came for the next Art Walk, and this guy, Richard Florence, had organized Chalk Walk. And we were basically taking it back and saying, you can't tell us we can't chalk. So we did this big thing that said, I heart the First Amendment. And we got put in handcuffs. But then they let us go because they said it was good art. The vandalism statutes in California revolve around the word defacement, whereas in like a state like Maryland, it's about temporary. So chalk again washes off. So it's more clear that chalk is okay, legal. But in California, it's kind of an art competition. And literally, the police spokesperson from LAPD said, well, it's good art, so we're not going to arrest them. So they let us go because it was good.
Wow.
So it's pretty crazy. The whole thing with chalking is very much legally in flux, which is what makes it interesting. I mean, this Eternity Chalk, the brand I use, is very beautiful. The colors are beautiful, but I mean, it's just messy to chalk, but you're kind of stuck chalking if you think you're going to get possibly arrested for basically taking the sidewalk, which is the only area I could find that wasn't already covered with advertisements that people with money had money to pay for. This was something where nobody wanted it. It's dirty. It's all available. So I've done a lot on the ground just because it's available. We also did do a project that where we clean the messages into the dirt on the ground.
You clean the what?
Clean the messages into the dirt on the ground. I called it Spray Team 6. And I think it's in the book. Like we went down to Wall Street in LA, which is in Skid Row, and it's filthy. And we had a beautiful aluminum stencil that says Wall Street, you're dirty. And we just basically power washed it about 13 times into the dirt. So... again, just the ground, take the ground. And now in this latest project that Pershing Square asked me to do, there are 6 art pieces for their concert series, their free concert series. I was tired enough of chalk that I pulled out some other mediums and they said, no, you can't use it. And then I said, oh, well, I can't do this if I can't use this medium. And so they were like, okay. And it washed up, so everybody's happy. But I actually used the highway marking chalk with stencils, which is the stuff they mm-hmm. use when they're going to dig, and they have blue for water, greens for sewer, yellows for gas, okay. red is electric, I think. And they're beautiful colors, and they're like super non-toxic because they're designed to either go on fields where athletes work out or on the ground where it's going to go into the water table. So mm-hmm. I just, in this last project, I've been using that chalk spray. Because it's too hard to get those details with like the kind you rub in. So yeah. when you just spray it down, it's super clean.
So your chalk use is evolving.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, when I can get away with it, I'm switching it up. Yeah.
So you, at the beginning of the book, you talk about forming something called the Fresh Juice Party. What's that all about?
Well, I really wanted to do something for Bradley now, Chelsea Manning. I'd seen the Collateral Murder video, which is just absolutely shocking. The behavior witness, the witness in there is just too much. And so I thought, I really want to help that person. And I had to figure out first who that person was. And then it turned out that this organization in Oakland was actually the one helping Chelsea Manning. And they were saying, oh, I wish I could get the Yes Men. And so I emailed the Yes Men, and they actually emailed me back saying, well, we can give you a Yes Lab. We can't do it for you, but we can kind of advise you. And they actually have great information on their site of how to do what they do. But we were going after a government person, and their technique is mostly like going after corporate people. So they put out like a fake email that's similar, like ExxonCompany.com instead of Exxon.com, and send out emails mm-hmm. and kind of troll for victims. But mm-hmm. I wanted somebody in the government who because they were, you know, Obama prosecuted more people under the Espionage Act than all the presidents put together since that act was instated. And even though I had voted for Obama and supported him, I was like really not happy with that one thing, and especially not Chelsea Manning, who it was clear. I mean, there, according to the Geneva Convention, any soldier in uniform is required to report war crimes, and it looked like war crimes to me. So, I mean, in a sense, Chelsea was really holding up the Geneva Convention. So, we're trying to figure out, well, how can we get Hillary? Actually, was like the one we were trying to get. But then I got this invitation sent to me, like Omelets with Obama. And I thought, well, this is just a gift from the universe. So I decided, I'll sign up. I'm going. And then we tried to figure out what we were going to do and how we were going to get that information out of the room. Because California is like a one-party consent state for video, two-party consent, excuse me. So like both people have to be agreed to audio tape, not video. So, like, in New York, you can secretly audio tape somebody, but not in California. So, I mean, as long as you agree and you're in the audio. But in California, so we were going to just do video, and we brought signs in that we were going to hold up. But what happened is Carla Marinucci from the San Francisco Chronicle pulled out her cell phone, and then it was all over the place. But in the planning, I was talking to some friends of mine, and they were saying, you know, they're just going to twist your message. It's going to get all, you know, distorted, and you're wasting your time. So what we decided to do is make a website and just tell the press, like, go to this website, and it had all our statement and the lyrics to the song and everything. So when I got escorted out of the fundraiser by the Secret Service, the reporters were all there asking what happened. And I would say, just go to freshjuiceparty.com. So we'd bought the domain freshjuiceparty.com, and it was kind of like fresh juice is like the opposite of the tea party, you know, but they're both on the breakfast table. So a friend of mine came up with that name, and for a while we were Fresh Juice Party, and now my friends who were in it with me have kind of taken away, and they have a band called Fresh Juice Party, and I just kind of dropped the name, and I don't really have a name for an organization anymore. I kind of prefer to be a more slippery target. As an activist, unless you're going to get paid, you don't really want your name. You just show up and you're the person that showed up and annoyed everybody with your chalk or whatever, rather than a.
Yeah, you sang a song right at the Obama fundraiser.
Yeah, the Bradley Manning song. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a really interesting thing, because you know, at the time, that was a big, that was kind of a revolutionary position. It was a big, you know, you were an activist. This was not something that was a commonly held belief, that Chelsea Manning was someone who we should actually be treating well and not throwing in prison. And right at the end of Obama's term, he commuted Chelsea's sentence, and Chelsea is now free. And that's just quite a switch, I feel like. I mean, from everything that happened, how did that make you feel? Do you feel vindicated?
Super happy. I mean, I hope Chelsea feels vindicated. I mean, for me, I was just there to support whistleblowers. I really believe in truth, and I believe that we all are qualified to know the truth. Like, we're not a bunch of idiots in this country. We deserve to know the truth. And whether our action made a difference or not, there's really no way to know. I was talking to another friend of mine who's a political artist, and he was saying, I don't know if it does anything. And I said, I don't think you ever will know. You just do it and you hope that it makes a difference, but you don't really know whether it was what changed Obama's mind.
Right.
And there was a lot of pressure from a lot of people.
Sure.
So, but clearly it let him know that people who were his supporters didn't like it.
Right. Right. And so you just, at the end of that story, you just mentioned how you kind of notified the press, and the press all showed up, and there was a reporter from the Chronicle there.
Oh, no,
they were
just there because Obama was there.
Oh, they were already there.
They were there. Carla Marinucci was in there, and she, when we got up to sing the, you know, Dear Mr. President, you know, song, she just whipped out her cell phone. And then when I got kicked out, of course, there were tons of reporters just waiting outside for anything that was happening. So between her and the people outside, it went pretty viral. I guess nobody had ever paid to go to a fundraiser and then stood up and objected before.
Right, right. How much did it cost again?
Oh, it cost way too much. It was actually inaccurate, the amount that was reported, because I reported the amount that we were supposed to pay, but they never asked me for the rest of the money after they threw me out. So it cost about $35,000, which is a lot of money for me.
Yeah.
But it was worth it. Like, I mean, like, if you think about it, if you tried to buy a page in, you know, in every newspaper in the world, it would have cost a lot more than that.
Sure.
So it was pretty good deal as far as the coverage we got. It was super cheap, maybe a couple $100 a newspaper. And you make actually in a story instead of a paid ad. So, I definitely couldn't do something like that every month, couldn't afford it. But I think it was worth the money.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just wanted to talk more broadly about the press, because obviously this is a big part of what you do is when you're an activist or an artivist, you want attention, you want people to know your story, you want to be heard. And so the press is sort of integral to that in its own way. And so I'm just curious about your relationship with the press, maybe how you feel about it now, how you felt in the past, how that's evolved, all that good stuff.
Well, you know, the press is people and everybody's different. Like, there's reporters who I really respect and trust, and reporters who I respect and don't trust, and reporters neither. In a sense, the right-wing media is more fun to deal with because they're really predictable, and you know they're just going to try to make fun of you. So it's easier. With the left wing is much more probing and sneaky, and you have to really be careful in what you say. But I mean, obviously the media is super important. The fourth estate, right? It's really important that they get the information to the people. It's a really important function. Mm-hmm. And a lot of important causes like Standing Rock, a lot of those things, the stories weren't really getting told. Like, bad stuff was happening there and it didn't really make it into the mainstream media. And the same thing with when Chelsea Manning, originally it was kind of, she was in jail, but it wasn't really in the media. So it's one thing getting attention, and it's also like getting attention and getting them to report like kind of like what you think is the truth. So, I mean, part of the thing is just showing up where they already are and giving them something to either take a picture of, which already has your statement in it, or a website that they can copy and paste. Something where it makes it easy for the message to be like translated accurately, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's manipulations too. I mean, a good friend of mine is named Joey Skaggs, and his entire art career has been hoaxing the media. Like, he makes up these outrageous stories, and then if the media picks it out, he acts them out. And wow. I've been involved with a few of them. And there's a movie about him called The Art of the Prank. It's really good. So, I mean, he had an influence on me too, that like, you can create a story. Mm-hmm. And you can create a story for truth. I mean, I guess that gets all into fake news and stuff, which is like a whole other story. But so I better be careful what I say. But I mean, I think a lot of the times the media is lazy, and if you just give them something, they're just glad and they'll take it and just mm-hmm. run with it without asking a lot of questions. But then again, I think that they're really pressured and that reporters aren't given the support that they used to be. And so that I don't really blame them for being kind of rushed and harried, but they are. They are rushed and they're looking for a quick story, and serving on a silver platter is a good way to get your message out.
Yeah. So you devote a good chunk of the book, maybe not a good chunk, but what's many pages, to something called the Whistleblowers Conference. And you lay out, you know, the different workshops that happened and the people that were there. So what was the Whistleblowers Conference? Why was it so important to you?
Well, we did the Whistleblowers Conference when we were still Fresh Juice Party, and we were just fresh off of the Obama caper. And we wanted to do something that was more from the ground up, that wasn't a stunt. Like, just kind of prove that we were capable of also organizing something complex, and that we weren't just clowns. And we felt like a conference would be useful for a bunch of different whistleblowers to get together and meet each other and support each other. And I mean, whistleblowers are just one of my pet projects in general, because truth is so important. And without the truth, how can we make judgments about what's good? Mm-hmm. So, we just decided to have it. That was the next project. And I guess we had it about 7 or so months after we did our stunt at the breakfast, and had a lot of interesting people who were whistleblowers there, who some of them I still know and work with, including Jesselyn Radak, who's an attorney for a lot of the whistleblowers and a whistleblower herself, a DOJ whistleblower. She blew the whistle on how they treated the American Taliban guy. Mm-hmm. Which was basically illegally. And Thomas Drake, who blew the whistle about a huge, wasteful, intrusive program for the NSA. And he was charged with the Espionage Act, too. And then John Kiriakou, who blew the whistle on torture. So there's been a bunch of different whistleblower people that I've worked with since. Because they really need support. I mean, when you blow the whistle, you're kind of considered a traitor, at least by the people you tell on who are doing the bad things. So you kind of need a whole new set of friends and people to support you when you make that decision. It's, you lose a lot. So you really need people, those people really need backup. For John Kiriakou, the torture whistleblower, he mm-hmm. had to go to prison. And so we threw him a big unrepentant going to prison party in Washington, looking down in the White House, making a big to-do about how we looked down on people who torture.
Yeah.
So that was another kind of PR event that we had, where we tried to change the story. He's not the CIA leaker, he's the torture whistleblower. But it was basically a we're not sorry, we did the right thing party.
Yeah. So you were involved with Occupy.
Yeah.
So talk about the Occupy movement and your involvement in Occupy Oakland specifically, and then Chalkupy.
Well, Occupy for me was a very beautiful moment. A bunch of people got together and rejected the values of greed. And while that camp was at the square, nobody went hungry. I mean, it seemed like they dumped a lot of homeless people on us and stuff, and there was always enough food for everyone. And there was always like warm clothing for everyone and anything anybody needed. It was clear that there really is enough. And it was a little bit like with the Black Panthers building up your own society, an alternative from within. And there was a lot of love for strangers. There was a lot of just joy. Like it was like a vision of a different society that wasn't based on self-interest and greed. And it was a beautiful thing. It was hard to see it get crushed. It was really, I mean, I guess that, you know, you can hope for one day that, that we could live like that without being so focused on being competitive with each other or, having more, being more special. There was a real, generosity of spirit that, picked up there. And I think in a lot of movements, it happens. When they took over, I'm not sure what prison it was, but there was this whole society formed when they took over this prison and they started their own kind of education and feeding people and, you know, the things society does. It seems like our society really needs to change somehow, and I don't know how it's going to happen, but it was like a glimpse of that possibility, even though it wasn't completely realized. It was a beautiful thing to see. As at least a temporary thing. I mean, there was a lot of bad press around Occupy too. Most of it wasn't true from what I saw. But anyway, what happened is they kicked out the Occupy Oakland camp, which also had tremendous humor. I mean, they had this great funeral for capitalism where they carried a coffin for 2 miles and then had all these eulogies and then they smashed it. A lot of fun happened. And so when they physically removed the camp, there was still this chalk. Somebody had written Occupy in chalk there. And they had about 10 policemen and 6 city workers all there just to remove the word Occupy. And a bunch of us were there and we said, well, why do you have to clean it? And they said, for hygienic reasons. And we said, well, the pee is over there. Why don't you clean the pee? And this one girl started chasing the guy, like, clean the pee, clean the pee. But they were only there to clean the word Occupy. And the police, like a lot of us said, we wouldn't move. And then they said that we'd be arrested for obstructing public access, which is one of the more common things protesters get arrested for in California. And by the way, the bail for obstructing public access is $5,000 in Oakland. And the bail for a pimp is $2,500. So we're worse than a pimp, according to Oakland. They're more lenient on pimps than people who won't move off the word Occupy. So most of us just decided to move because the police said, well, you can put it back again. We just need to clean it. And so we took that to heart, and we put it back again about 50 times. And we had him on tape saying we could put it back, so there wasn't much they could do legally. So we chalked the police a bunch of times, too. Like about some of the abuses that, you know, about the people they've killed, about that sex scandal with the young girl. So, but there wasn't much they could do about it. We were kind of grandfathered in at that point.
Yeah. Huh. So before the show, I asked about suggested reading, and you suggested John Lewis's Walking with the Wind and Mark and Paul Engler's This Is an Uprising. So I've read Walking with the Wind, but not the other. I'm just curious why you picked those two books.
Well, Walking with the Wind is because, like, John Lewis is about as close to a hero as I have. Like, he seems to me, and I don't know him particularly personally, I've met him once, but he seems particularly humble and dedicated to the cause, and, like, he's someone who's kept his ego in check. It made me feel a lot better to find out that he'd been through some of the similar struggles that I'd been through. And just his kind of tenacity and workhorse kind of mentality, his humbleness was really inspiring. I mean, the civil rights movement is a movement that I really look up to. I think they did everything right and they won nonviolently, which is kind of a new thing. Nonviolent, winning with nonviolence is very new to history of man. And, of course, they were big followers of Gandhi. And this book, This Is an Uprising, kind of talks about nonviolent resistance and how it really can win. It's kind of a book on the theory of it. It separates it into two kind of schools. One is the, I think it's Saul Alinsky model, where he was big on building things grassroots from the ground up, picking a small issue and getting that one dealt with, and then taking the base that you've developed from that and growing it. Whereas the Francis Fox Piven model was more mass movements, like the Occupy movement, where there's this huge movement going on and everybody can jump in and push for what they want. And like if you think of the NGOs, they were kind of reluctant to get into the Occupy movement because they already have kind of, they have something to lose. And they don't want to get, you know, caught up in something that's not going to work out or might be bad for their reputation or whatever. They're more cautious. And the book kind of was synthesizing the two different styles of nonviolent revolution or change making, and talking, you know, the strategy of that, where John Lewis's book goes through his philosophy. This is more of a discussion, but it's, you know, his story, a memoir. This book is more of a discussion of the theory and application for nonviolent resistance. And it was just really inspiring. It made give you hope that you actually can win. You can lose every battle and win the war, like with Chelsea Manning. And there's so many things that need to be changed in our society, at least according to me. And and the idea that you can do it nonviolently is just such a joyful idea, because I don't see, you know, dying to get communist China or communist Russia or any of these like results of revolutions that were violent revolutions. That those regimes are just as bad, or bad in their own ways. So I think the only way you can hope for a different societies, if your revolution is like a positive one, if you want a nonviolent society at the end of it, you need a nonviolent revolution. So that was just a book that really gave me hope and joy.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a little bit about video and audio and taking photos, and I wanted to briefly talk about the technology around all of that. And you talked about something. You talked about CodeFrame. I think actually that was his code name, maybe.
Yeah, that was one of our live streamers.
Yeah, so talk about live streaming, and more broadly talk about how technology is shaping what you're doing now.
Well, in Occupy, we always looked at live streaming as what kept us safe from prosecution, because the thing about live streaming is they can't take your phone away. It's too late. It's already up on the site. The minute you've recorded it, it's up on the live stream site. So it's like a permanent record. So we always felt that it was like our vindication, that if we had a video record of everything that happened, that they couldn't twist it later. We had the record that we didn't do this or we didn't break that. So it was always kind of in my mind and many of our minds, it was like, you know, getting the news out first of all, and also getting it out in a way that they couldn't like erase it. Because, right. I mean, and there's so much tech wars going on, like, in these movements. They basically shut down all your cell phones now. They did it in Washington, too. And they have those cell tower emulators, or the brand name that they often call them by is, Stingrays. And basically, they're soaking up every single call you have and blocking your communications. And they really tried to keep the story of Standing Rock from getting out. We were always trying to, like, find ways to get the comms, you know, unblocked. Because then they can make up any story they want about what happened. And they do. I mean, the police literally, the sheriff went to every farmer, every rancher, and said, the Indians are armed, you know, arm yourselves. And it was a complete lie. I mean, anybody went into that camp, you knew that weapons were absolutely forbidden. Alcohol was forbidden. If you had a weapon or alcohol or drugs, you were kicked out immediately and never allowed back in. So, I mean, the narratives that they tried to create were just absurd. But so, I mean, as far as when truth is your concern, you always need a way of getting the truth out. And the first thing is just having the actual ability to broadcast it, which is something that now there's this little war going on between the activists and the government, I guess, or Tiger Swan in the case of Standing Rock. I mean, it was just this private security firm that wasn't even licensed to operate in North Dakota that was like literally flying Cessnas over us and just fritzing our phones, hacking our phones, putting microphones in the hotel rooms, all kinds of really creepy stuff. And then when we were in DC for the Women's March, it was very similar. Like if you note on your phone, you'll see instead of like LTE, you have 3G and you can barely text a friend, much less make a call or live stream. So they really are trying to block all those comms so that we can't get our story out. It's like this weird, you know, war of communications.
So talking about DC, there was the FUBAR. I liked that story. So maybe just quickly talk about FUBAR and how they ended up in the hands of congresspeople.
Well, the FUBAR was actually a friend of mine's idea, Seth Lair. He said, you should make this thing a FUBAR. And he drew out this little sketch of, you know, blasted off feet. And, you know, FUBAR stands up for like fucked up beyond all reason or recognition, or there's some different variations, but it's basically so like the idea there was a candy bar, that was his idea. And one day again when I was low on projects, I decided to try and make it. And the hard part about that is actually getting the right silicone that you can make like food shaped food with. Like there's a lot of much easier to use products, but they're not food safe. So we had to get this stuff that needed to be at a certain temperature, and it had to have a vacuum pump to pull all the bubbles out of it, and it was super tricky. But then once we had the molds made, it was just a matter of making the soldiers, pouring the melting chocolate and pouring it in, and then painting them. I put lots of different uniforms on because I like clothes. I got bored of the same outfit, so I kept like changing up the outfits. But I mean, it was this soldier with a missing leg and an eye popping out. It was really gruesome. And so I basically called a bunch of news agencies and told them that I'd made this thing, and we got in Huffington Post. And then Code Pink offered to on Valentine's Day, they gave them out. And I wasn't actually there, but I think a couple of people from Code Pink went and stuck them on some congressman's something or other. So I don't know if they actually, you know, ate them. But a lot of people who I did give them to, they really weren't that good. But people would get the munchies in the middle of the night and eat their FUBAR. Like, so a few people like called me up and they were all embarrassed. Like, I have to tell you something, I ate the FUBAR. It wasn't really that good, you know, like, it was too sweet.
Right.
But it was just, you know, a thing to do. And we made a little song and a video that went up with it and went with it. And that went kind of like, you fucked up, you deserve a FUBAR. I mean, I'm a terrible singer, but, and then we had like this little card and it said, you know, you've been personally selected to receive a FUBAR due to your unique lack of humanity.
Yeah.
So, you know, it did. That was one of the ones that didn't go that far, but it was a fun project. It was just fun to kind of use a different medium.
Yeah. So, yeah, and that's a good segue. You know, you have a section at the end about making activism fun. So maybe talk about what your thoughts are on making activism fun and why that's important.
Well, I mean, people always go where the fun is. So if you want people to join, it has to be fun. I mean, you have to like convince them that it's worth their while, and fun is a good way. And I actually thought a lot about what makes something fun. I interviewed kids, and the interesting thing about fun was there wasn't just one like thing that makes something fun. There was requirements, like nothing's fun if your basic needs aren't met. Like you could be at Madonna's like mansion partying with her, but if you're dying of thirst, it's not fun, even if you're with Madonna at her mansion or whatever. But once your basic needs are made, which isn't fun, but they have to be met in order for you to have fun, then there were so many different elements that made things fun, but none of them was essential. Like, I mean, being with friends was one of them, but you can have fun alone. like sensory input was fun, but you could have fun just in your own mind without sensory input. Creativity was fun, but you could have fun just watching something that was entertaining. You don't have to be creative. And then my nephew said that danger was important. He said, for instance, playing Commando Hunt in the schoolyard in the daytime would be boring, but playing in the woods at night would be fun. So it's this weird combination of those things. And I guess when you want to make something fun, you try to bring in as many of those elements as you can. Like, for instance, when we do a chalk, there's all this color and there's the creativity. Like, people have their own kind of area and they can have their own kind of creative autonomy within their spot in the artwork. And we would make sure people have water and soap to clean up with, and we feed them afterward. And also, like, give people a little bit of a voice. Like, with this one we did called Homeless Wish List, we made all these little, like, pictures of, like, Post-its, and then people who had been homeless or were homeless were allowed to write wishes. And we gave out socks, because homeless people always need socks. So there was, like, sometimes a, you know, participatory part of it where people could have a voice as well. And I think so, like, the things that, you know, make it fun are having a voice, being creative, being around the color, being around other people that feel the same way you do. At this, for John Kiriakou's party, I made sure the alcohol was free.
Yeah. People like it. Brings people to parties. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was actually, we had to turn people away. I made sure I paid for the parking too, because the two things that make it a drag are, like, if you have to buy your own alcohol and if you, you know, if you have to drive around looking for parking. So those were the first to the two things I made sure people, so there's different ways to make something fun, but I think it's always important to make it fun, because it can be so grueling. Activism can be a long, hard, grueling road. So, try to make it something that people will enjoy, so they want to come back and keep doing it.
Yeah. That sort of wraps up the questions I had, but I always like to ask, are there any other lessons or takeaways that you hoped people would learn that we haven't got a chance to cover yet?
Well, yeah, there's a big takeaway for me from all of this, and that is, don't wait, don't ask, take it. Like, now I kind of have domain or whatever over this corner in Pershing Square, but nobody said it was okay to chalk there. And if I asked permission, I never would have gotten it. So, I mean, I had to have the balls to go there and chalk, and, you know, 14 police end up showing up, but we got away with it. And then we were able to come back and say all different things. Same thing standing up at the fundraiser. I wasn't invited to stand up and sing a song. We just did it. So I think that the big takeaway I've taken away from most of my activism is that you can't wait for permission. You just have to take it. You have to, you know, demand the change. You have to take the spot, take the floor, or whatever it is. And then you hopefully can do it in a way that's charming enough that people want to repeat what you said or show people, because otherwise you're just offensive and annoying, then you have totally failed. The design is always like how to make it palatable, convincing, fun, funny, all those things. But yeah, just take it. Like, people were like, how did you get it, this spot? And I was like, I just took it. I did not ask. And in fact, the lady who ran the park said, can't you get a permit? And I was like, no, I won't get a permit, because then I can get arrested for a whole slew of things that come with the permit. And since I'm already not breaking the law, the city attorney has ruled that chalking is legal now in Los Angeles, then forget the permit. But, you know, but work with her in other ways. Like, I actually really like the lady who runs the park, and she loves art, and we get along. But I would never, I've never gotten a permit. I got a permit once for this project I wanted to do in Oakland. And by the time I had gotten through the process of getting the permit, I didn't feel like doing the project anymore, because it was so onerous and it was just so niggling and picking and annoying that I was like, forget the permit thing. I mean, permits are good. You know, I'm not saying don't get them, but yeah, if you don't feel like getting a permit, don't, you know, and you can take a little bit of risk, but that's the excitement. Like when we go and do one of our cleaning things, like we did one that said LAPD, get clean. And we did it right in front of police headquarters, and we dress up like city workers so that we can hopefully not be noticed. But there's a little bit of excitement too when, you know, you might get arrested. And, you know, I try not to get ever arrested for anything that my trial wouldn't be fun. Like, you know, I can picture my trial for cleaning. I'd be like, well, Your Honor, I was cleaning. I missed some spots. Or with the chalking, you know, okay, well, Your Honor, it's the First Amendment. How are you going to throw it out? Like, I don't want to be arrested for anything tawdry or tacky, but something fun where your trial is like a further performance and a new part of the activism. And you get, you know, you can be like unrepentant and that kind of thing and make the jury laugh, hopefully. That's great. I mean, I'm still looking forward to that day. I keep getting away with stuff, but one of these days, I guess I'll get a trial, hopefully. I kind of want one, but only the right trial at the right time.
Yeah, I was about to say, be careful what you wish for, huh?
Oh, yeah, no, right? yeah, well, I want for the right trial.
Yeah.
Like, if you think of some of the great trials in history, they were, like, pretty entertaining, you know? Like, the Chicago stuff. I mean, I don't really want to be charged with inciting a riot. That would be kind of scary, but... maybe vandalism, you know, will be okay.
All right. Noted. Cool. So let's just wrap it up. I'd like to have a thunder round, a couple quick fun questions, and we'll call it a day. Sound good?
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll start off with, what's your favorite food or drink?
Well, I drink a lot of tea. And I, chicken stir fry. That's kind of my comfort food.
Sounds good. I mean, I eat stir fries every day, as my roommates know. So,
yeah, it's like, you know, I'm pretty happy with a stir fry.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Fresh fruit and salad. Like, boy, you know, when you don't get enough of that healthy
you're
food,
in trouble.
But not like bland. Yeah.
Right. Cool. So, where's your favorite place you've ever been?
Maybe Madagascar.
Oh, wow.
I got really sick there, but I'd still go again. It was amazing. Like, they have all these chameleons and lemurs, just all this nature, which is completely unusual. And it's like really, really different from the United States. And the people were so like warm and lovely, just really nice people. I mean, it's a very poor country, but it was spectacular.
And the food was good. And the food?
It was good. You have to be a little careful about it, but it was delicious. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. So if you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
Everybody would care about every other living thing. Like, all sentient beings would care about each other because, like, Gorky once said that if everybody took care of their little corner of the world, that it would be paradise. So I figure if everybody cared, you know, there wouldn't be all these abandoned animals or destruction of the environment or poverty or abuses towards American Indians and stuff. Like, if we all just cared, that would be my wish. My job would be a lot easier.
Yeah.
If we cared about each other, not just ourselves. And if we understood that, it's really the best for ourselves too. You know, the best things in life aren't things.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Well, thank you so much, Naomi.
All right.
Political Art Diary, Occupy Artivists Take the Streets. My guest, Naomi Pitcairn. Thanks again for being on. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.